This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 264.
This podcast is brought to you by NewKneeShop.com. Don't let knee pain keep you from completing your long runs or worse, sideline your training altogether. New Knee is designed specifically to relieve runners' knee pain. Check it out today at NewKneeShop.com and use the code MTA20 for 20% off. That's NUNEE shop.com and use the code MTA20 for a 20% discount.
This episode is also brought to you by Anolon. Whether you're impressing friends with a twist on an old family recipe or experimenting with a bold new dish, Anolon's gourmet cookware is designed to unlock your creative vision. Anolon's wide selection of gourmet kitchenware combines innovative technologies with durability, performance, and style, all with a lifetime warranty. Shop Anolon's cookware sets, baking tools, and even pasta makers and culinary torches all at Macy's. Anolon, designed for creativity in the kitchen.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast, where we empower you to run a marathon and change your life. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we interview Dr. Mark Cucuzella about his new book, Run for Your Life, How to Run, Walk, and Move Without Pain or Injury and Achieve a Sense of Well-Being and Joy. And just a heads up, you can see the video portion of this interview and get access to all of our back episodes and training plans with an Academy membership. Find out more when you visit MarathonTrainingAcademy.com. Okay, Angie, so like tens of thousands of people out there, we got our rejection notice from the London Marathon. What did the email say? Commiserations?
Commiserations. It also went on to say that a record number of 414,168 people applied for the ballot, and they only had 40,000 slots, so there were a lot of rejection letters going out.
That is a phenomenal number. I mean, especially given that there's only about 500,000 people in the U.S. that run a marathon every year.
Well, it's a huge race worldwide. I mean, people from multiple countries apply to get in. And plus, there's also a lot of people who have never run a marathon before who just kind of enter on a whim. We saw a couple posts on social media kind of to the extent of like, oh, crap, what do I do now? I just got in through the ballot. You know, well, seasoned marathoners were like, ah, we won in.
Well, we have tried to get in this marathon many years. Just every year we would enter the lottery. But the good news is, I guess for us, that we're going to be able to run it with a charity spot, two charity spots, because Angie and I are both running it, for the John Muir Trust. If you heard the last episode when Angie recapped the Loch Ness Marathon, we talked about the John Muir Trust, and Kevin, a listener who works at the Trust, has been kind enough to reach out to us. So we're going to be running it, it looks like, next April.
Yeah, we're very excited about that. And, you know, talking about the John Muir Trust in the future as well. So definitely looking forward to doing another World Marathon Major Marathon.
So that'll be April 28th, 2019. And if you're going to be there at the London Marathon, send us an email. I'm sure we'll have a meetup either before or after the race. I'm sure that'll be here before we know it.
Yeah, time usually flies when you're having fun.
And speaking of having fun, we've got some shout-outs. People that are having fun with their running and also getting in better shape with their running. So what do you got from MTA land for us today?
Yeah, lots of exciting things. Obviously, October is a huge race month, and so we've got lots of people. This is just a small slice of all the people who are achieving a lot of great things out there. But we'd like to say congrats to Academy member Stephanie. She ran her first 50-miler at the Indiana Trail 100, so huge accomplishment there. Rosina said, I completed my first half marathon on Sunday in the worst rain I've ever ran in. I'm so thankful for the training podcasts that are in the members area. They got me round the course, remembering my why, and pulling out of my bag my positive affirmations I had stockpiled. Thanks, guys, for the training and the MTA resources in general.
Oh, that's awesome. Big congrats, Rosina. And she mentions different training lessons in the academy. We have a whole course on just mindset stuff that's really helpful for people who are building up to becoming long-distance runners.
That's right. And Andrew in the Academy really echoes that need for a strong mindset. He says, I'm very excited to say that I'm now a marathoner after finishing the Melbourne Marathon. I cramped up at mile 15 as it was much warmer than I'd been used to. But I just remembered all the advice Angie and Trevor had given me, and I let the Kraken come to life to beast through it. I paced smart and finished strong, all things considered. It's so true that the last 6 miles are a gauntlet. All the energy gels and bananas can't help you there if you don't keep mentally strong. Thank you, Angie and Trevor, for preparing me for that. Overall, I had a blast. It was a great time and an awesome experience. This note comes from Aaron. He says, I want to give a big thank you to MTA coach Chris. Today I ran my first ever marathon under 4 hours in 3 hours and 57 minutes at the Mount Desert Island Marathon. It took me 8 tries over 6 years, but the training and fueling plan advice of coach Chris finally helped me achieve that goal. Alexandra posted, I got a 19-minute PR for marathon number 2, all thanks to Coach Jen. I'm one of those people who doesn't like doing things over again for fear they can never live up to how great it was the first time. My first marathon went so great that I didn't want to do it again for fear it wouldn't be the same. But I hired an MTA coach to hold me accountable and get me on track. She got me to the start line injury-free and well-trained. Despite some challenges during the race, I finished with an awesome PR, and I couldn't believe I was hitting the pace as I was and feeling as great as I was. It wasn't great conditions out there, but I had a great ending. And this note comes from Brent. He says, last Saturday, I completed my first marathon, the St. George, Utah Marathon. Special thanks to the both of you and MTA coach Steve. Those downhills were a killer, and my constant mantras were relentless progress forward, and God gave me the ability, the rest is up to me. I've heard others say this, and I'll repeat it. The first 21 miles were just a warm-up for the real marathon, which didn't begin until mile 22. That's when I had to dig deep. I planned on running the first 3/4 of the race with my head and the last quarter with my heart, and that's exactly what happened. My time was 4 hours, 10 minutes, and 23 seconds, and I'm so glad I did it. The experience was deeply moving, a true spiritual journey. I got a runner's high that left me seeing everything and everyone as part of a sacred experience. I learned a ton about myself, bawled like a baby at the end, and came away just as proud as I could be of my son, son-in-law, and friends who ran this with me. Every time I see one of those 26.2 stickers now, I think to myself of all the respect I have for them. You guys said that I've got what it takes to run a marathon, and I'll be forever grateful that I believed it with every step. Happy trails, and that comes from Brent.
Wow. Thank you so much, Brent. What a thoughtful recap of what it's like to run a marathon, not only your first marathon, but I can identify with that even now. I mean, I have a tough time after mile 22, and you're right. You just got to gut it out, you know, from the heart, from the guts, wherever.
Wherever it needs to come from.
The emotional experience is real. I still tear up at the end of marathons a lot of times. Even though I've done like 16 now. But major congrats, Brent, on running the beautiful St. George Marathon. We've heard a lot of good things about that. In fact, it sells out quick, doesn't it?
Yeah, I believe so.
Well, keep up the great work, all of you. And of course, we're in the fall season when it's a beautiful time to run. Lots of races going on. I hope this episode empowers and inspires you. We're talking to Dr. Mark Cucuzella. We had him on the show, I think, twice last year. He's a very interesting, well-read guy. A little background on Dr. Mark. He's a board-certified physician in family medicine and professor at West Virginia University School of Medicine. He is a 2-time winner of the Air Force Marathon. He also helped develop the Air Force Running Program. He's an interesting guy because he's helped his local hospital there develop like a low-carb path for diabetes patients. And I think he talks about this in his book. They even became like a sugar-free hospital. Who'd have thought, you know?
Sounds like a good idea to me.
Sounds like every hospital would be that way. But yeah, he's really making such a huge difference there in his community. He's also the race director at the Freedoms Run Marathon, which just took place in early October. And he's owner of a running store called Two Rivers Treads. So a lot of stuff going on. In this interview, you're going to hear about fixing your posture and how our posture affects our running. And then we'll also get into zero drop shoes and the wonders of the human foot, really interesting stuff. And then finally, we'll spend some time talking about zone 2 training, how that you have to slow down to get faster. So without further ado, we'll go ahead and get into our interview with Dr. Mark Cucuzella.
Well on my way, well on my way.
All right, we're on the podcast now with Dr. Mark Cucuzella, author of the new book, Run for Your Life, which is an awesome read. Dr. Mark, welcome back to the MTA podcast.
Well, it's a privilege to be back. We had a good time last year, Trevor and Angie, doing a couple shows and you visiting my store, meeting some of my tribe there. So that was good.
That was a lot of fun.
Nice to pick up the conversation.
Yeah, I had a blast going down there to Two Rivers Treads, and it's like you've built a running mecca down there in West Virginia. What's the name of your town? Remind me.
Ranson is where my store is, Ranson, West Virginia. There's like three small towns that neighbor on each other. Charlestown, which is two words, not Charleston, which is 5 hours away on the other side of the state. And Shepherdstown is another small. These are all historic Civil War towns, George Washington era transportation towns that are trying to revitalize. Like, you're up in Pennsylvania, a lot of these small towns in Pennsylvania, they have a lot of charm, and trying to bring small businesses back to these towns is a challenge.
Yeah, definitely. I got to tell you, the last time we had you on our podcast, it was the most downloaded episode. 59,000 people downloaded that episode. So
wow, that was the nutrition episode. So people are confused, interested. I don't know what the right word is. I thought I thought you had a running podcast. This wasn't like
it all works together.
Nutrition for runners. It was about.
Yeah.
So I was really thrilled to see that you wrote a book. I actually had no idea you were even working on one, and then boom, you emailed me about it. And this thing is a goldmine. Angie and I just finished it. Was this your first book?
It was, and it'll probably be my last for a while. So if you guys train people to run marathons and ultras, maybe this was way harder than any single day event.
Well, I have to say, I can tell that you put, you know, your heart and soul into it, as well as, you know, decades of experience, both as a runner and as a physician. And no matter what a person's level of a runner is, they're going to find something of value in it. I mean, you know, I've been reading running books for many years, and it's so, so interesting, and so many great reminders, new stuff in there. So yeah, thanks for all the hard work you put into it.
And I got to tell you, just it's a good sized book. It's pretty thick, over 340 pages or so, but you kept the chapters short, and I like that.
I probably should have had 26 chapters for, I think I kept it at 19, but then we had, you know, a few appendixes and things.
Yeah.
But yeah, you have, it's, I guess in the way I wrote that is maybe the way, you know, you teach people to run marathons, you know, it's 1 mile at a time.
Yes.
You know, so, okay, I'm going to write about like nature and take me a month, you know, because you're trying to do this in your free time, which is non-existent. You know, so you find yourself sitting at an airport with a delayed flight and you break out your computer.
Wow.
And again, apologize to your listeners. My voice is gone. And finally coming back, I directed a large race last weekend, you know, going into a little bit sick, and that wipes you out. So I'm finally getting my voice back. So I feel pretty good today. So I sound worse than I feel. I have some nice herbal tea here while we're talking.
Well, as I was reading this book, I was often sitting reading it, and I have to say, one of the things that you emphasize over and over again is that movement, and especially correct movement, is health. And, you know, you kind of hear the old adage, like, you can't out-exercise a bad diet, but you're also saying that you can't out-exercise a sedentary lifestyle. So kind of talk to us about that, because, you know, we're talking to runners who are probably more active than the general population, but often also have a very sedentary lifestyle on the side.
Yeah, I think it was Gina Collada or Gretchen Reynolds, one of the New York Times writers, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, wrote an article about the active couch potato syndrome. You know, and that's the person who, you know, has their Fitbit and gets their whatever 30 minutes of designated cardio or something, but then the rest of the day, you know, they're driving in their chair, watching television. And I think most of us know this, you know, you got to do more than just that. May be a minimum daily requirement. I think the lead into that chapter is don't exercise, you know, just move, you know, because when, you know, I'm 52, actually today's my birthday. So 52.
Oh,
so
wow.
You know, there weren't gyms. I mean, the only places when I was growing up that had gyms were like a designated gym for a specific, you have some YMCAs and, you know, maybe your high school had this little old school gym with some barbells. You know, that was my high school gym. It didn't have any fancy stuff, but you just moved around a lot. And, you know, we played outside, and you all are interviewing me now from a stand up desk, and I have one too. And it's not that you need to stand up all day, but, you know, your best position's your next position. So just mix it up and just try to do more. I mean, this shouldn't, you don't need scientific studies to tell us this, but, you know, there are scientific studies if you want to look them up. It's called NEAT, And that term is non-exercise activity thermogenesis. So just blah, blah, blah. But so the people that have the most NEAT, so think of like a waitress in a busy restaurant on a busy shift. They're getting, you know, I have a, and she's lost over 100 pounds, mostly by fixing her diet. I have a, my hospital's three floors. And she's one of the facilities, you know, she cleans the rooms and she's always texting me her steps. She's getting 20 to 24,000 steps a day just in three floors of this little hospital, you know, 24 bed rural hospital. I mean, I'm trying to do the math. I don't think I ever get 24,000 steps and even carrying my phone, even the weekend runs, you know, even that like weekend 2 hour run, I don't think gets to 20. So she's getting like my long run, you know, which is like a long run, right? And every day, just walking around. So she doesn't need to go to the gym. You know, she's just getting that time. And those jobs that entail that these days, I think you're in the minority. I get a lot of steps at work because I work in a hospital. So when I look at, like, I have my iPhone, and at the end of the day, you know, I might have 20,000 steps, or, but 25,000. But most of those are not running. You know, they're just, I take the stairs, you know, based, and the medical students and residents, sometimes I'm on the, we call it the service, you know, the inpatient service. They don't even know where the stairs are. So we're taking the stairs, and they look at me, where's the stairs? I'm like, you're kidding me, right? This is a 24 bed hospital, and you don't know where, because the stairs are not in a convenient place in my hospital. You got to go down to the end of the hall. But that's what, you just have to do that every day. And I think it gives you energy at the end of the day. You know, if you just, I think most of your audience would just know if they kind of got out of a 10 hour car ride, they're exhausted. And if you had a day where you just walked the dog and did some chores, you feel energized. And that day you may actually want to go out for a run. So everyone just needs to figure out in their own lives, you know, how to add a little more of that. And that's going to help full body mobility too. So, you know, to pick things up. These days, you know, we don't even do anything. You could spend your whole life and never raise your arms above your shoulders these days. Right. You know, so put some things on high shelves, you know, and then add in those strength training exercise that get you to do things that you wouldn't do in that normal picking up the groceries, you know, lifting your kids, whatever it is you're doing.
I think a great point that you made was, like you said, change positions regularly and don't just have that default setting being slumped in a chair. And in your book, you go through so many great illustrations and pictures about different ways that you can sit on the floor, different ways you can sit, but not in the traditional, in a chair, not in an anatomical position that's healthy for, you know, running or just for daily life.
Yeah, I think that picture, you know, there's actually a Scientific American article. There were like 100 different sitting positions, you know, so just most of us know one, which is in a chair, but just go down on the floor and just watch kids. You know, they're all going to sit in these different positions. Try to, like, each week find, and you're going to be stuck the first time, right? You're going to be like, oh, this sucks. You know, maybe if you're doing a first yoga class, you know, trying to get into that position. But work your way there. Try to find maybe once a month, find a different new sitting position where you're, you know, your legs are long sitting, your legs out, you know, inverse Indian style, you know, one knee kind of rotated in, the other externally rotated, you know, so there's all kinds of different positions, squat, you know, kneel.
Yeah, I remember reading, I think in there about how we don't really squat anymore, and ancient man probably didn't sit the way, you know, they didn't have chairs. So maybe they would sit on a rock, but they would probably squat.
Yeah, squatting is actually one of the assessments I do for runners. You know, people that actually want to run competitively. I think if you just want to run for activity and cardiovascular health, get outside, you know, people don't need all these prerequisites. Just go out the door. You don't even need shoes if you don't want shoes. But to, you know, for people that want to load it up, meaning, you know, go do track work, high school cross country runners, train for a marathon, you know, being able to get into a deep squat comfortably tells me they've got good range of motion in their ankle, in their Achilles, in their gastroc soleus, which is the calf complex, in their plantar fascia, in their hips. So it's just good. I think, you know, can they safely go out and do things with a little more stress to the body? You know, it's not a guarantee they'll not get hurt, but if they can, you know, if they go down about halfway and are stuck, or, you know, do they want to wear a more minimal shoe? Even race day, I want to go put on some racing shoe, which has, you know, no drop at all. You know, the racing shoes are minimal shoes for the most part. You know, just yellow flag caution. So that, yeah, work your way into a squat and just keep doing that for the rest of your life, I think, is a good bit of advice.
Well, I thought it was interesting how a book about running, you actually start with, this is how we walk. This is how we stand with correct posture. So it's like you gotta crawl before you walk. You gotta walk before you run. Mm-hmm. How important is that for runners to start with just posture before they even start racking up miles and training for a marathon?
Yeah, it's a really good question because the word posture is thrown out a lot now. But I think you need someone to assess whether your posture is correct, because you could watch a video, read my book, think you're in the right position. But, you know, if I came back behind you and tried to pull you down and you were just off and you weren't aware of that, you're going to, well, I think I'm doing this correctly, and you keep reinforcing it. So really, you should have someone assess you. And the videos we share on the website can show you how to do that. We have a website, runforyourlifebook.com. That's open access. And there's a couple posture videos that show assessments and corrections. So make sure if you're going to work on posture, someone actually instructs you correctly, so you're doing that right. But no kidding, how you stand is how you land. And if you're off in your posture and you're going out for a 10-minute walk run for fitness, that's different than loading up, you know, for 26-mile marathon.
Yeah.
You know, that's where the stresses might hit in. Because back pain, you know, is common in runners. Hip pain, you know, neck pain. So these are just ubiquitous, not just for everybody doing any activity. So iron that out. So again, before you're going to load the system up, you know, make sure we're structurally sound and do the best you can. No one's going to be perfect, but most of us have lost that normal posture, mostly from shoes and chairs. You know, those two things will really do a number on your posture. If your foot's up at a 10-degree elevation in the heel, you've got to compensate in the knees, hip, and back. That's non-negotiable. It is what it is. So very difficult to be in an ideal, stable posture in an elevated shoe. And if you just get rid of the shoe, your brain's been trained into this balance point, which is off, you know, for however many years. That's why the kids keep, you know, you guys have young kids, you know, keep them in these little flat shoes, and then they won't need to listen to this podcast later and read my book. You know, ideally, you know, they wouldn't need the damn book, right? They're just good, normal, non-zoo humans.
What are some other ways that you've seen runners have imbalances in their posture? Like, how does that manifest in later life?
Yeah, when I look at the main posture issues I see, most of them are people in what I would kind of call the back seat, meaning their upper back is kind of swayed back.
Okay.
And most of that is because they're trying to balance. So if you had a stack of blocks and I were to put 10% grade on the bottom cube of blocks, you know, you probably have some blocks for your kids, right? There's little alphabet blocks. Stack up like 10 of them and put a 10% grade at the very bottom, or 10 hockey sticks, you know, if you're in hockey pucks, not sticks. And then you're going to have to shift all of them, you know, as you go up the chain. And that's going to happen to balance you. So it starts there. So find posture starts with the foundation of the feet. So if your foundation is off, just like your house or any structure, the rest of it's compensation, so it doesn't tip over. Like the Leaning Tower of Pisa, they've had to do structural adaptation, so it still kind of looks like it's tipping, but there's things that are strutted in there so it doesn't fall. Their whole tourist industry would go to pots. So, and then, but the tight hip flexors also make a big difference. That's from sitting, because then our glutes don't function well. So if our glutes don't function well, running is a pendular gait, meaning our leg has to go in front of us and has to extend behind to have just a good rhythm when we run. And if you can't get any extension when you run, you're going to be off. Mm-hmm. And then upper back and shoulders, because, you know, most of us, you know, 80% of our workday is in a position where our shoulders are forward, our head's forward. You know, whether we're typing, texting, driving, you're in kind of this position, and this position will throw your balance off running. So your chest needs to be open. You know, if you watch like Eliud Kipchoge running, you know, his chest is very open, and his wrists are kind of just right up against his torso as if they had Velcro. I think we had those little rubber bands, Trevor, when you came.
Yeah.
When we were on the Trueform, that little strap.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so Kipchoge doesn't need the strap, right? You watch him running, and his hands probably don't stray more than 2 inches from, like, his armpit, you know, or where his nipple is, you know, so he's just right there like it. But that's just natural for him because he's in a good upper body posture. So you kind of start at the bottom. You got to keep it simple. You know, you can't have 15 steps to fix your posture.
Sure.
People will just get confused, but start with the bottom and just kind of stack it up from there.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, that illustration about putting a block under your heel and how your whole chain, your whole kinetic chain and your whole spine, everything's going to have to adjust to keep yourself balanced. And that's not ideal. And getting to a minimal shoe so you're not having to compensate. I really found that fascinating. We've been running in minimal shoes for a while. I know that you kind of had a journey to minimalism back in the day. What got you interested in minimalism?
Yeah, that was like really back in the day, right? So yeah, this is like the year 2000. I guess maybe that's the day. Yeah. I don't think anyone, but back then we all had these things called racing flats. So, but I had my feet operated on in 2000. I had, you know, kind of common term would be a bad bunion deformity of both my big toes and bad arthritis in those joints. So if you look down at your foot and if it's shaped like a track spike or a ballet slipper, you had the problem I had. You know, we all squeezed into these shoes and ran track. And then, you know, I had all these injuries that were going on. I didn't understand them. You kept treating them. But then it ultimately got to the point that, you know, I was at the Air Force Academy, and one of the orthopedists looked at my feet and said, you know, your feet are really screwed up, you know, for a 30, you know, no, hell, gosh, yeah, I was in my mid-30s then, you know, but I had a lot of miles on my legs. So I had the operations where they take out some of the bone, but it really doesn't straighten your toe because all those muscles that pull on that toe are tensioned, you know, and then the muscles is called the adductor hallux. So if you can, like if your kids can actually spread their toes wide, that, and probably not many in your audience can do that, like your fingers, you know, spread them wide, but kids can always do that. So that muscle was like gone, you know, just shredded from. So I got done that surgery and I'd pretty much given up running again as competitive. But a couple months later, my dog is in here with me now, but my other dog was looking very sad because that dog was my running partner. And she's like, when are we going to go run, Dad? Right. So, yeah, a couple things happened. I also did some reading about aerobic development and slow running then too. I'd come across some of Phil Maffetone's work. So I went out into the park and just started like running ridiculously slow. And when I started running again, I pulled out just some more basic, you know, shoes, like, you know, more minimal racing flats. They still had heel elevation. And so I got back into, like, I think through the endurance training, and I think we talked about that on the last podcast, just slowing down, you know, this is Lydiard type methods, Maffetone methods, you know, building that aerobic speed, you know, how fast can you run while burning fat? Yeah. I got pretty fast again, like 6 months into that, I ended up lining up at the Marine Corps Marathon just kind of by accident. I'd kind of opted out of the Air Force team that year because I hadn't done any workouts, you know. It's like, well, you don't want me to run, right? I'm just jogging around the park with my dog at a heart rate of 140 or something. But at that point, after 6 months of doing this, I was running like low 6-minute-ish mile at a heart rate of 140 around Washington Park in Denver. Amazing. You know, starting from like an 11-minute mile at a heart rate of 140. So I was just building this efficiency. And I lined up at the Marine Corps Marathon and went through halfway in like 115. I didn't even feel like I'd been out for a jog yet, you know, which is kind of a weird feeling in a marathon. You know, you're just kind of like, wow, like this is weird. You know, I'm not even working. And I came back in 113 and finished third that year.
Wow.
And you finished third at the Marine Corps Marathon.
Yeah, it was like a 2:28 or something. You know, it wasn't my fastest time, but it was effortless. You know, I finished it and said, man, I could like turn around and do that again.
Yeah.
So I got back into running and I had a contract with Brooks Sports at the time. They had brought a guy on there named Trip Allen, who was one of the lead design guys over at Nike. And they brought him over to Brooks to shake things up a little bit. And his passion was really the biomechanics of running and shoe design. So he understood what was going on in these old school, more flat, minimal shoes versus the new big structured shoes. And he knew that wasn't a good direction for human biomechanics. It may have been a good direction for marketing and shoe sales, but it was not a good direction for biomechanics. So his little side projects were, he was prototyping these zero drop shoes, and he didn't call them zero drop. I don't think anyone called them zero drop, but basically he called them flattened shoes.
Okay.
So one of the shoes that he had designed was one called the Brooks Burn, which if you look at that shoe, it had a little pod at the base of the fifth metatarsal, like on the outside, it had this little pod. And that's, so if you look at your foot, that little piece of your foot should be on the ground, right? There's a little fat pad there, but a lot of shoes were starting to cut that away, which makes an unstable platform. So that shoe had that pod, but Brooks didn't want to make it a zero drop because all the shoes had, you know, 10 mil, 14 mil But he would just took a saw, like he had this factory saw, so he would level them out, you know, and I'd get these shoes, which was that shoe basically, but it was cut off to be level. And, you know, I'd done a lot of the reading about the cadence and the short stride and the not overstriding and the midfoot strike, but I didn't really understand the role the flat shoe had. No one was talking about that at all. And then the other shoe I liked at that time was, it was called the T5 Racer, which was another, that was the more minimal racer. So that one had about 10 mil drop. So that was another one that I was cutting off and making a zero drop. I mean, that was a beautiful shoe at zero drop. I mean, that would be like any of these minimal, you know, it had a little bit, I'd say probably the closest shoe to that right now is this new Ultra Vanish, you know, which is just a little strip of foam, which was very similar to every shoe probably made in the early 1970s.
Right.
Other than they had wider toe boxes. The Ultra has a wider toe box, you know, like a Merrell barefoot 6-ounce shoe, wider toe box, more anatomically. Some of these older minimal shoes, track spikes, like which wrecked my feet, older racing shoes, very, very narrow toe boxes. So everything about those old school shoes was right, other than that they squeezed your toes. They're super, super narrow. If any of you have any of those in your closet, you know, from back in the day.
Talk about the genius of a wider toe box and letting your toes splay.
Yeah, so it's really more the genius of the human foot than the shoe.
Sure.
Gosh, I mean, the human foot, no kidding, you could make an anthropologic argument or an evolutionary argument that the human foot is why we exist now at the top of the food chain. Read Dan Lieberman's story of the human body about the multiple facets of the human design, which allowed us to hunt prey, develop a large brain, you know, have voice, speak. I mean, you name it. But the big toe in itself is a very unique, and the human arch, because we're the only animals that can run and walk on 2 feet for any extended period of time. And the rear foot, there's a bone structure in the rear foot, part of the calcaneus, this little bridge of bone called the sustentaculum tali. And when that is in the right position and your big toe is in the right position, you have a beautiful arch, you know, just like you would out in any Civil War battlefield with one of those old stone bridges. Mm-hmm. You know, an arch is supported on the ends, not in the middle. That's why it's really flawed to think we need to support our arch with an arch in the middle. No, we need to support our arch to do what the arch is supposed to do by having the front end in the right position and the back end, you know, or both sides of that arch.
Yeah.
So when the big toe is bent in, basically your whole foot collapses. And it's probably not too hard to envision that. If you wanted to just experiment yourself, spread your toes real wide and jump rope, you know, pop, pop, pop. You know, if you're doing that right, you could probably do it effortlessly for hours like kids could do. Now squeeze your toes together, take that big toe and smash it in and try to jump rope. And your foot becomes like a hacky sack. It's not pretty. And imagine now you're trying to run 26 miles. So the human arch will return 50 to 70%, like a Super Bowl, right? You drop it to the ground. It's not going to get 100% energy return. But the human arch, when functioning normally and optimally, will return 50 to 70% of the energy just by the, you know, the fascia, which is the connective tissue, and the muscles, the four layers of what we call intrinsic muscles. These are like your hand, right? Like everyone's got strong hands who works with their hands. You got these muscles. Now, you could go to the shoe industry, and they'll all make these claims of energy return, and a shoe cannot return energy. That just, you know, it's nonsensical that a shoe can return energy, but even the best designed shoe doesn't come close to what, like Eliud Kipchoge, right, what he ran, 201? Is that right? Am I getting that right? Yeah. 2130 something. But he's a human spring.
So what about the runner who has more of a flat foot or a low arch? Is that something that can be compensated for through strengthening the feet? Or, I mean, what do you recommend in that situation?
Yeah, so just looking at an arch, whether it's flat or high, really doesn't mean anything without looking at the function of the whole foot. You know, because having a flat foot does not mean it's a dysfunctional foot. You know, if you go to look at the African runners or travel to developing parts of the world, they all have flat feet because they're loaded with muscle, but their feet are functional and strong, and the tendons work well, the fascia work well, the big toe's in the right position. So they're good, right? Don't mess with them. You know, they don't even need shoes, right? They've got these big, thick, like lumberjack hand kind of feet. Yeah, they're good. And then there's someone who has, and we have to look at the rear foot structure. It's called the talus, which sits in the mortise of the ankle. So if the foot where you're standing is collapsed in, meaning your big toe's bent in and your those little bumps on the inside of your ankles, most people kind of know what that is. If those are just collapsed into the ground, that's a dysfunctional flat foot. And we teach an exercise called a short foot posture. So you're trying to get that foot more into like a lunar lander position. You know, the foot needs to be springy. So you can't just like over email, you know, doc, I got a flat foot. What do I do? That's why a lot of the paradigms of, you know, and again, all the evidence points to the opposite is true. So, you know, those paradigms of you walk into a shoe and they look at your foot and it's a flat foot. We need to put an arch support in you. You know, it's not based on any science. So just be careful if someone absolutely tells you you need this or that based on flat feet. Kids, and actually this is true because I wrote a textbook chapter on pediatric footwear. So young children who have flat feet, you know, the old school thinking was, well, let's just brace their feet at age 3 and give them arch supports. Those children at age 7 or 8 are more likely to have a weak and dysfunctional flat foot than the kid you just leave alone. Now, that should make sense. I mean, the kid's learning how to walk, and the only way those muscles are going to learn to develop normally is let them walk barefoot, right?
Yes.
And the muscles that need to turn on will ultimately turn on. The kid's not training for a marathon, hopefully, at age 3.
When our kids were little, I liked those little soft leather shoes, like those Robies.
Yeah, Robies.
I had them in those until they outgrew them because I felt like their feet, well, first their feet were so fat, you know, it was like hard to fit them in the cute shoes, but
yeah.
But I figured it was better for their coordination and development and those muscles and everything. So
yeah, just let them be normal kids develop, just like your hands. You wouldn't, well, a child's hand needs some strengthening. You wouldn't put a child's hand in a cast for the rest of their life. You'd say, well, let's go play with some Play-Doh, you know, climb monkey bars, right? Grip, all that stuff.
I really find the foot fascinating. In the mid 90s, I traveled to Papua New Guinea and we were in many of the rural areas there, and people had never worn shoes in their life, and their feet, I had never seen feet like this before. I mean, they were spread like our hands. They were functional. They were calloused. They were strong. They could run over incredibly challenging terrain and not even bat an eye. They could climb trees with their feet. It was just,
it was
amazing. It totally changed my paradigm of the foot. Yeah. So.
Yeah. They only were, they could never imagine bringing like a box of US shoes over to their, they could never fit in those shoes. They all just wear the sandals because their feet kind of spill over. Maybe like an ultra shoe would work over there. But
yeah,
any other, like, you know, you bring a bag of demos, you know, from your local running store, Nike demos, they'd be like, I can't wear these shoes.
Right.
You know?
So someone listening to this interview and they want to transition to a flatter shoe, to a minimalist shoe.
A wider toe box.
Yeah. What do you, how do you recommend that process to go? You don't want to just like jump right into.
Yeah. And I describe it in the book, and most of it's just, you know, common sense, which, you know, I think Mark Twain said is not very common these days. So yeah, like this is not an event. It's a process, you know? So,
yeah,
you know, and it was very nice to see. So I got back, I was at the American Academy of Podiatric Sports Medicine conference, their national conference in San Francisco a few weeks ago. And a number of the speakers were talking about wearing these lifestyle more minimal shoes during the day. Just people were sharing studies of foot strength and minimal shoes. And, you know, it shouldn't be surprising that the less shoe we wear, the more the muscles, you know, get commissioned, and the more shoe we wear, the muscles get decommissioned. So gradual, I think I always suggest that the first step to make is, you know, most of us walk more than we run, you know, unless you're just total sedentary desk job. You know, walk around in a shoe like a Lem shoe or a Vivo Barefoot, or, you know, if you can wear like a very minimal running shoe to work, if you're in a more casual work environment, walk around in those shoes and then, you know, gradually start to reduce your shoe while you're running and then see what that area of comfort is. But mix it up. You know, I mean, I think the body, you know, if we say there's one correct shoe and this is the best shoe, I mean, like, is there one best workout for running? I mean, no, like that's foolish, right? Everything has its importance. I mean, I've got, you know, a garage full of different shoes, but in the summer, I rarely use any of them. I just run barefoot. But if I'm going to go on a trail, I'll go grab something that's a little beefier, you know, but mix it up. And that's, I think, you know, people do that. They pull out, I think the most foolish thing is for people to do all their training in one type of shoe and think they've got some magic race day shoe, you know, that they're going to pull out that they've never worn, you know, fresh out of the box, weighs 3 ounces, and they're going to throw that on, you know, for something longer than a 5K. Don't do it.
Yeah.
So if you got a fall marathon coming up, don't do that. You know, if you're going to use something more lighter, minimal, that's your shoe that you should be going to a lot, certainly for
your long runs. Like
this weekend, you've got a long run, say you're running Marine Corps Marathon or something in 3 weeks-ish, you know, go throw that shoe on this weekend, you know, and see how it feels, you know, wow, there's a hot spot, you know, in the heel, I better wear like a sock that comes up above that, you know, you're just going to figure it out. Oh man, you know, that shoe that did not feel good. People think that less is more, but that isn't true unless that's how you've adapted your body.
So for a person who, they look down at their foot, they see their toes are all smushed together, maybe from years of just wearing these very narrow shoes, you know, dress shoes are often that way. Would you suggest that they get something like Correct Toes that they can wear
yes.
in their off hours and just start to try to change their
yeah.
foot a bit?
Yeah, there's some different exercises you can do too. So maybe put a link for Correct Toes. And that was, I started wearing these when they were prototypes, like 10 plus years ago. Somehow I saw this on the web and I contacted Dr. Ray McClanahan, who at that time was kind of a rogue in his field because now he's accepted. Now he's brought back to speak at the conferences, but he was like the dark sheep. You know, he's saying that, no, maybe everything we're doing is backwards. And now, yeah, I mean, his Correct Toes are in multiple podiatry offices. They kind of look like pedicure things, but
yes.
they spread your toes out, but they can fit in your shoe.
I've got
and another
right
thing,
here,
yeah, there you go,
wearing.
Right? Trevor saw them in my store.
Yeah.
But another thing at the end of the day just feels really good. These things called yoga toes. You can't stuff them in your shoes. You know, they're a wider variety of Correct Toes
mm-hmm.
that just really spread your toes out. But say you are on your feet all day. You've deserved a little lazy boy time with a little glass of wine and put your feet up and maybe read the paper or something and put your toes in there. And it's like, oh, that feels really good. It's like totally. You should be able to take your fingers and put them between your toes, you know, kind of like knuckles, right? Like and if that's really uncomfortable, all that tissue is like super tight in there. So you have to take each individual toe and start to extend it a little bit. Extend it meaning bring it down to the ground and try to loosen that. The big toe especially, so it's called the toe extensor stretch. You kind of grab that big toe, kind of pull on it a little bit, and then kind of bring it down and out, you know, kind of like you're straightening it out. And you get your thumb kind of between that first and second toe, kind of up a little higher in the foot where all that tissue is like super tight. But over time, between some of these manual techniques and using the Correct Toes, you know, I've seen, I have a plantar pressure map in my store where it takes a footprint and, you know, gives an image on the computer. So I've seen people, they come back 3 months later. So I've seen feet change shape, you know, and people say, no, your feet can't change shape. It's like, no, your feet can change shape, but it's not going to happen blindly. You know, you have to make it just like you could get rid of sugar and your body will change shape, right? You'll get rid of belly fat. Just watch it. Trust me. It'll work.
That's right.
Well, I hope you have enjoyed this conversation thus far. We'd like to take a quick break and thank this episode's sponsor, Noonie. We emphasize injury prevention here on the podcast. We've talked about runner's knee in the past. If you are dealing with runner's knee, the good news is you don't have to let it sideline you. There's a device that's been developed by a podcast listener and also a two-time Ironman named Mike Emmerling. He had his own battle with runner's knee, tried all the different braces and things that put pressure on the knee. Nothing seemed to help. And as an engineer, he decided, how about I just make my own device? So he started researching exactly what causes runner's knee, and it's when your patella doesn't glide smoothly, so kind of like grinds along there. So if the pressure is taken off and the patella is allowed to slide and glide smoothly, then the pain goes away.
And the neat thing is that Noonie is a solution that's based not only on Mike Emmerling's experience, but also on research. you can relieve that pressure on your kneecap, then you can get relief and continue your training. And Mike found that he was able to train pain-free and no longer has to modify his training to accommodate knee pain. And there's been runners all over the United States who've been helped by this device. Nooney has even been 5-star rated by running injury specialist Dr. Ben Chateau. And we know you've trained hard and we don't want that knee pain to slow you down. You can stop runner's knee in its track by going to newkneeshop.com. That's N-U-N-E-E shop.com. You can use the code MTA20 for a 20% discount. And as a bonus, we'll include the Resilient Runner. It's a course and guide to injury-free running.
We'd also like to thank this episode's sponsor, Bombas. I'm actually wearing a pair of Bombas socks right now. I ran 4 miles on the treadmill before this episode was recorded. We love Bombas socks. Thanks to 2 years of research and development and multiple improvements in design, performance, and comfort, Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. And we all know the history of feet goes way back.
We talk a lot about feet in this episode and how important they are. Yeah, Bombas have a nice arch support system that provides extra support where you need it the most, with a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without adding bulkiness. Bombas feel like a hug around your feet, which is why they get a lot of rotation in my sock drawer. So whether you're a runner or any other sport, there's a pair of Bombas that will add comfort to your life. So just go over to bombas.com/marathon and use the code marathon for 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, B-O-M-B-A-S. .com/marathon and use that code marathon to get 20% off your first order. So we've talked a lot about the foot, which, you know, we could probably do a whole show on the foot and building stronger feet and how that's the foundation. You talked a little bit as you were coming back from your foot surgery, how you basically just built a very solid endurance base by doing zone 2 training. And you mentioned Dr. Phil Moffitone. So I know we get a lot of questions about heart rate training. It seems like people don't know exactly what it is or how to do it correctly. So I think it would be really helpful to delve into that, you know, talk about what it is and, you know, how people can build that strong endurance base for themselves.
Yeah, and this goes way back to Arthur Lydiard, and, you know, so that's how he trained his runners. And, you know, simplicity is the ultimate sophistication, and I didn't make that one up. I think that was Da Vinci. You know, at least it's attributed to him. So if it's not simple, people won't do it, right? If it involves like 16 different zones and things and beeps. But basically what you want to do is, your body has really two pathways of making energy, and they're always mixing a bit. You know, you've got the glucose utilization pathway, which is tapped into at higher intensity. And if you're just kind of, you know, persistence hunting, you know, walk into the store, you're in fat burning metabolism. So what you're trying to do, like, I mean, and runners need to be, no kidding, these are longer events in life, not just running. So health is really being efficient at your fat burning. Then you can actually eat dinner, go to bed, and, you know, go for a morning run and have lunch and not need to be snacking on carbohydrates. You know, you're good to go. So you want to raise that speed where you're burning fat, and then you never bonk. It's a beautiful thing, and you're never even afraid of bonking. Mm-hmm. You know, so I'll line up for a marathon, and there's a lot of variables. You know, there's weather and all kinds of things, but one variable that's nice to have off the table is nutrition, meaning, okay, I need 6 gels, it's 20 miles, or no, you don't need any if your body's using fat. Now, if you want to take one, just if you feel like you need a little glucose, that's fine, but you're not reliant on that. So how fast you can run while burning fat is a critical factor in your health and your fitness. And so you build that by slowing down, right? Because when you slow yourself down, you're forcing your body to tap into that, and you're building capillaries, you're building mitochondria. You're starting to convert some of these, what we call them, fog fibers. They're called type 2, the fast twitch oxidative fibers. So these are, most people have heard about these fibers. So we have fast twitch and slow twitch. So you want to train, if you're a marathon or a distance runner, meaning really anything over a 1 mile race, you want to train those fast twitch fibers to be oxidative, meaning have capillaries and have mitochondria to be able to be tapped into for endurance. So when you start doing slower runs in these depleted states, meaning you're not having bagels and gels, you tap into those fibers after an hour. So you're starting to recruit. It's like doing covert speed work. You know, you're recruiting fast twitch fibers without running hard. And I think the holy grail of running, because, I mean, who wants to go out and run hard every day? Life is hard. You want to get fast without running hard. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that good. Like you want to get fast yeah. without it being effort. And that's aerobic development. If you move up the threshold of speed at a fat burning zone, you're actually moving up your lactate threshold too. That's the red line. So the milers who do a lot of base training like this, you know, easy running, but they're running a mile, that's a sugar burning event for sure. But they're moving up, they're building a bigger aerobic capacity, and they're moving that red line up. So they'll be oxidative, you know, up until the final lap where the other person's already acidotic. And you see what happens in the last lap of a mile. The one, you know, who's most aerobic still is not going to crumble to the ground. Right. You know, they're going to speed up because then they can go anaerobic. But it's actually really simple. And, you know, if you need a biofeedback tool, most people need at least something somewhat instructive at first because they don't have intuition yet. You know, their perception of easy might be, I'm not dead yet. So I work with the military and Marines and, you know, Air Force pilots. To them, like, what is easy? It's like not dead, right? So they'll just run hard. I'm running easy, right? But, you know, like textbook, no, that's not physiologically easy, but in their mind. So they need a cue. So 180 minus your age is a good cue. That's the Maffetone formula. So if you're 50, I'm 50, so 130. Somewhere in that range is stay below there and you just stay there and you see what happens to your speed. You know, you're running a 10-minute a mile at that speed and then, okay, I'm going to stay with that lower heart rate. The next month you're running a 9-minute a mile. The next month you're running an 8-minute a mile. That's what happened before that Marine Corps marathon in 2000. You know, started at like a 10 or 11-minute a mile before it would go beep. I had one of those old school Polars. It would like, but I was like, whatever, you know, I'm just learning to run again. My type A before that would have been, this is a stupid thing, I'm throwing this out. But I was just glad to be outside. So I was like, what the hell, you know, I might as well just try this. Yeah, and then after 6 months, you know, got down to, you know, pretty close to 6 minute a mile at a heart rate of, at that time was like, you know, 140, 130. I'm sorry, yeah, I was 30 years old. So it was probably somewhere, I probably had it set at like 145-ish, you know, but the speed and efficiency and it, you know, it was pretty obvious running the race, you know, you get to halfway and you're still fat burning, you know, so you're not tired. You feel like, wow, you get this energy that just crazy kicks in. And that's how it goes.
So. It's pretty amazing stuff. So a lot of people will find themselves after they do that calculation, their age minus 180 and they keep their heart rate.
180
minus their age and they keep their heart rate there. That they're going to be running barely faster than a walk.
Or sometimes just walking and they say, hey, what's going on? I'm just walking. I can't.
So you're saying just stick with it for 6 months.
Stick with it.
Or however.
But I also get people to mix in. So, and Lydiard did this and he was very misunderstood unless you read his books. So they're called alactic sprints and drills. So, you know, at the end of every run today, I went out. It's beautiful fall morning here. I don't know what it's like. This is like the first true fall morning.
It is.
Wonderful. Yeah, I have a golf course pretty close to me and the 18th fairway is nice flat grass. You know, went super easy run today. And then, you know, for about 10 minutes, I'm doing a series of skips and very short sprints, 40 meters. You know, so you're not building up acidity, but those things keep you fast without running hard. You know, it's like dynamic stretching. So you're keeping that speed and that neuromuscular coordination, range of motion. So everyone should have a little toolkit. Because if you just go out and jog slow every day and you expect to run faster, it's, you know, it might not work smoothly because you still have to keep that system awake a little bit. And as you get closer to a race, you start to do more specific things. So tomorrow, yeah, we're about 2 weeks from the Marine Corps Marathon. I'm going out with a couple friends, and we're going to do like 2 hours. We'll go out and mellow, and we're going to come back at marathon pace, which will probably be higher than that 180 minus the age.
Sure.
But that's okay. We just want to rehearse, you know, just get wake up, you know, whatever pace it is that you're going to run the marathon, but not for full 20 miles or something. That'd be stupid. You'd leave your race out. So it'll probably be like a 15-mile run, but you know, come back and you always feel good. Like you always feel like, wow, you finished like with your strongest mile, you know, so that, but I wouldn't do that in the middle of July. You know, that wouldn't make any sense. But if you're 2 weeks from your race, that's just enough to wake that system up a little bit and without taking you over the top.
Yeah. Cause we do get a lot of questions about this. And there was a helpful illustration in the book talking about the two systems that could be engaged when you're running and you compared it to a hybrid car. You can burn sugar, which is like flooding gasoline into the engine, or you can burn fat, which is like relying on your consistent, stable
battery.
Electric battery, right.
With no exhaust, which I think is critical, because the exhaust is the inflammation. You know, when people decide to slow down and switch their diet up a little bit, I think the crazy thing is what they notice is what they don't notice. You know, the next day, God, I don't have this tweakiness, you know, like, you know, how, I mean, you all have had it. I've had, it's like, yeah, you just, you know, things are a little, it's like weird. You wake up and you feel better than you did.
Tell me if this is right though. So if I'm out there and I'm keeping my heart rate in that zone two, which for me is like 142, and I'm chugging along at that, which feels pretty slow at this point still.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden I decide I need to sprint. Maybe a dog starts chasing me.
You don't want to run if a dog's chasing you.
I don't. Yeah, the dog will catch me. Something scares me, a rabid squirrel, who knows. So I start running as fast as I can. Then I'm burning sugar at that point. I'm not burning fat. Like my body, the system switch inside. Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, here's there's a lot of confusion with this. So here's what I think to, again, simplify. You want to teach your body the capacity to use fat as fuel.
Yeah.
Once you've trained that, that doesn't just go away. If you've never trained that, you don't have it. So if you've spent, you know, a year, 2 years, or say you were just a kid who ran to school, right? Like every Kenyan. So every Kenyan has developed this massive capacity to use fat as fuel. They're amazing fat burners. When they put them in the lab, their Mafitone heart rate is way higher than 180 minus their age, because they've built that just by running to and from school. That's at a conversational pace. So when you've built that, then you can actually go out of that box a little more. If you've never built that, it's going to be different. So if you've built that base, sure, you want to go, you know, the old lady's passing you and you're embarrassed because you're male pride. Damn, that guy, you know, he's like, isn't that the guy who does the running podcast? And he's really slow.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is that guy doing that? And then you're just, you know, you're kind of like your pride. But no, it's okay. So it's, I mean, the term is called metabolic flexibility. But most people don't know what that means. But what that means is you have to build the fat burning engine. Once you've built that, and the longer you've built that, the more capacity you have to utilize the other part too. And start to utilize that more, because then that's going to be, you know, your ace in the hole.
Sure.
Come race day, you know, because real racing is surging and recovering. It's like, who can recover the fastest, right? Because everyone, okay, I got to go up this hill, or, you know, say you're on a track or cross country meet, you know, you're following whatever move. But the key is, like, whoever has the biggest aerobic capacity is going to be the one that can buffer that acidity and recover. No one's done. Like, no one runs out of fuel, right? That's silly. People don't run out of fuel. You know, they just, in their mind, they say, I'm done. And when their mind says they're done, because if they're convinced by the sports food industry that they're going to bonk and it's all about sugar and they bonk, everyone can recover. No kidding. But if you build a fat burning engine, you will always recover, because you've got enough fat on your body, even the leanest Kenyan, to run from here to Atlanta. You know, and it's okay.
Right.
And then you're not afraid to surge. You know, you're not afraid to, okay, let me just shake it up a little bit, you know, open my stride up a little bit. You know, I'm in a funk.
Yeah.
But you're not afraid that, oh, last time I did this, I bonked. And then you've got that little demon on your shoulder. Oh, I'm going to bonk if I, and then that always holds you back. You want to just be relentless and not have any, you want to have enough confidence in the way your body works that you can take some risk. Which isn't really risk, but because you know you can always recover, but not be afraid to go for it every now and then.
That's how Frank Shorter got ahead of the competition back in 72 when he won the Olympics. We interviewed him 2 years ago.
Oh, I think I heard that. Yes. He decided on the turn.
He just kicked really early and got ahead of him and just held on to it.
And Joni Benoit, right, at mile 3 in LA, right? Isn't that when she separated?
Yeah,
that's crazy. So. That took guts.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so just to circle back one final time. So if somebody wants to build this fat-burning engine, it sounds like eating less sugar, eating more fat, which is kind of what we talked about last time we had you on the podcast.
Yeah, you could go back and listen to that one.
Exactly, and slowing down.
Slowing down.
Not getting rid of your speed work days, you know, if you're doing one.
Yeah, go do that, but your recovery days should be, like, if you're not recovering in that zone, you'll never recover, right? So Frank said this, I don't know if he talked about this on your podcast, I heard him speak, and one of the most profound, he was his own coach, and he was a lawyer, he wasn't an exercise physiologist, but he just knew, he said, the more I did the intense stuff, the more I had to do the easy stuff, slower, and the more he had to keep the easy stuff, because if he didn't know why But he knew that was true. So the more he went fast, the more he had to keep the other stuff. So probably people have, you know, read an article, which probably didn't exist when he was running because they all were like 140 mile Lydiard era people. But you can just do your speed work. The rest of it's useless. It's like, no, if you lose that aerobic capacity, you have no foundation to hold up the speed work. And it's just, you know, it's like Pisa. You know, you're going to fall off the cliff. Ultimately, you'll just fall off the cliff. And plus, he knew that.
Yeah, but a lot of people have a lot of stress in their life. And so if you're running as a source of stress to your body because you're not getting a necessary recovery, you know, you're shorting yourself on sleep. You've got a lot of stress in your life. It's not a good combination.
It's not going to work.
Yeah.
Ultimately, it's going to just be a disaster. That's why running is recovery. So if you're listening out there, and if you don't feel better when you come in the door than when you left the door, I think you're doing something wrong. You know, you should always feel better when you come back. Like I went out and ran this morning. I felt way better when I got home and when I went out the door. So that should always be the goal.
Yeah, I like that principle. And that'll help people, like when they go through periods of maybe illness, you know, maybe just go out for a walk instead of feeling like you have to hammer out a hard run, because that's not going to help you recover. Just, you should feel better when you come back than when you leave. So yeah, I like that.
The training is the recovery.
It is. This week I was sick, you know, from organizing that race. But I did go out and jog like Sunday and Monday. But I think I was probably jogging like a 12 or 14 minute mile just to get like blood flow and just get outside in the air. But yeah, the thought of running any faster than that was just like, oh no, you know, I mean, you all been there, like when your body's kind of viral and, but just, you know, it's not bad to go out and run easy. They say, oh, don't run if you got a cold. I mean, that's not true either. I mean, if I felt worse when I came back from that run with a cold, I probably wouldn't have gone out the next day, but I did feel a little better. You know, I still couldn't talk, but that's okay. But I was like, well, at least I got some fresh air.
Yes.
You know, your digestion's going again and blood back to your brain. It's okay to go out and run with a cold. But if you're coughing your lung up, then that's probably not a good idea.
Right.
Well, it's been good, Dr. Mark. If people want to learn more about the book and about you, where can we send them?
Yeah, so we built a website for the book called runforyourlifebook.com, and it's got a lot of videos on there that we link from the book. But you can find the book. Probably the best place to get the book is just go to my store, tworiverstreads.com. You can order it from my store. We even have a free book special that if you purchase shoes or anything at $130, we'll just throw the book in.
Nice.
You know, we're trying to help local business, you know, so most people now do all their shopping at big boxes and online. So if you want to support a small community running store, you could do it. If you're interested in all this Maffetone and training and health, Phil and I are doing two-day courses throughout the country. We just did one here in West Virginia. And these are for medical providers and coaches. You guys would actually like coming to one of these.
Yeah.
Health Fit You, like you. So healthfityou.com. The next one we're doing is in Dubai. So if any listeners are actually over that part of the world, and then we're doing one in Galveston, Texas in the last weekend in March, and we'll probably be doing LA a little bit later in the spring and coming back to West Virginia.
Nice.
So those are nice courses for people that are a little geeky about all this stuff. And Phil is an amazing teacher. Just to listen to Phil, he'll drill things down in like one slide that people have written books on. You know, here's one slide, right? Like simplicity. If this stuff cannot be made simple, we might as well all get out of the room. And that's what I want to pass on to people, that it all actually is pretty simple.
And that's the beauty of the book too. So congrats on putting that out. I know it was quite a Herculean effort to get this book written, but it's well worth the read.
Kids are glad it's done. So.
Like our dad is back.
Like vacation, you know, I'm like dragging my laptop, you know, cause you're on a plane or, you know, just because that's sometimes the only time like you get a break from everything else.
Yeah.
So now, yeah, I hope it sends a good message, and you know, we'll see. Thank you for sharing it with your audience. You know, I think everyone would get a little something out of the book. It's meant for, you know, entry level people as well as people with more experience. So hopefully something for everybody in there.
Definitely.
Definitely is.
Our pleasure. Good to talk to you, Dr. Mark.
Yes. And happy birthday.
Thank you. 52.
You're making it look good.
Another one down.
All right. Well, big thanks to Dr. Mark for spending some time with us. on the MTA podcast. We honestly had no idea that it was his birthday. He didn't mention it until we got on the podcast. Again, the website is runforyourlifebook.com. And of course, we will link to that over on our website, marathontrainingacademy.com. If you haven't visited us on the website in a while, or maybe you never have, head on over there and see what it's all about. We've got an about page, which talks more about why Angie and I started the podcast, a little bio of ourselves. Plus, you can see, you know, some short bios of our coaches. And we have all kinds of articles and resources for you as you are taking on the marathon journey, whether it's your first marathon, your first half marathon, or an ultra, or getting faster. We got you covered over there. We also have a contact form if you want to send us an email. And of course, you can connect with us on social media at Marathon Academy on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. So that brings us to the end of this episode. Thank you so much for being a listener. Thanks again to Anilon Gourmet Cookware for sponsoring this episode. They've got a wide selection of kitchenware, and they're well known for their durability, performance, and style. We're honored to have them as a sponsor. You can find Anilon Cookware at Macy's. More great interviews coming your way in the months ahead here on the podcast and other good stuff. So until next time, keep taking action in your goals. And remember, you have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Run on my way.